Today on Against the Grain. Our modern world was born from destruction, and no more so than in North America, which historian Clifton Craes describes as the most violent place on the planet in the 18th and 19th centuries.
They enshrined gun ownership in their constitution, and they pursued violence in really quite profound ways, and were and did kill and destroy everything they could if it made a buck. When you add the destruction of indigenous populations with the destruction of the natural world, what became the United States emerges as a uniquely and profoundly violent place.
Craes describes what he calls the Mortocene against humans and the rest of nature. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. From roughly 1750 to 1900, humans and the rest of nature were laid waste by a vast proliferation of guns. Along with the mass violence of slavery and the dispossession and killings of indigenous peoples, whales, bison, elephants, and countless other creatures were slaughtered for the profit motive. Clifton Craes is the author of The Killing Age: How Violence Made the Modern World. He's professor of history at Emory University. I spoke with him recently, although it should be noted, before the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran. Here's that conversation. So you argue that the world we live in is the product of the worst violence and destruction in human history. And we'll spend the hour discussing the period from roughly 1750 to 1900. But broadly speaking, why do you argue that that period, which of course is before the two world wars of the 20th century, was the most violent?
Sure. I mean, there are a couple of things. One is the spread of weapons, and specifically the flintlock musket. So there was a global distribution of weapons, and guns ended up in the hands of peoples who had used much different kinds of arms in the past. That's one part of it. But the other and linked part of it is that this is the time that you really see the kind of big bang of capitalism. And so what is happening here is that violence is being used quite uniquely in the pursuit of economic gain. And so you're literally killing for capitalism. And it's this kind of combination of economically driven violence that leads to really pursuing anything and everything that might yield wealth that in the West would be turned into capital. So in, you know, large parts of the world, the most valuable asset were human beings. And so the flood of weapons into Africa fuels the Atlantic slave trade of literally humans, you know, hunting other humans. And this led to catastrophically large deaths across the African continent. In other parts of the world, it was, animals, particularly in North America, beaver, deer, bison, and across the oceans, whales. And so when you add up both the destruction of humans and non-humans, the period begins to look much, I think, differently than we're accustomed to. You know, one of the things I did in the book was simply to try to take a census of at least part of this destruction. And that's why, once you add it together, a lot of the words that we use to describe this period just didn't work any longer. And that's why I coined a new term, the Mortising.
Do we have any sense, can we have any sense of the scale of destruction that took place in that approximately century and a half around the world, considering, as you do, not just humans, but the non-human world?
This was a huge challenge. And what I tried to do is come up with fairly conservative estimates. But, working through the records of, say, the whaling industry out of New England, especially New Bedford, we can get a pretty good sense of the scale of the destruction of whales. And then working through the records of the American fur company that was headed by John Jacob Astor, we actually have quite meticulous records on the number of deer skins, bear skins, beaver skins. And so we can use those to get a sense of the number of animals that were destroyed. And then in terms of humans, the records are also uneven, but we can get a sense of things. Even I was shocked when I went into the project. I was really following the lead of where did the guns go and what were they being used for. But when I began to tally the information up, it really was kind of mind-blowing.
In many histories, one would read that the period that you've written about was a period of great human advancement, the period of the Enlightenment and the rise of democracies and the technological infrastructure, of course, that undergirds our society. How do you understand those features of the age, the Enlightenment, the rise of democracies? Do you see them as almost things apart, or can we not understand them without understanding the massive violence, kind of the defining violence of the period from around 1750 to 1900?
Yeah, well, I think this is one of the great, paradoxes of the modern age, that at least one defining aspect of Western modernity was this belief that humans were there to conquer nature. So, you really could have two things unfolding largely simultaneously, a sense of the importance of human progress, including, ideas that we usually associate with liberalism and the Enlightenment, go hand in hand and at times support the conquest of nature and, including the conquest of other human beings to kind of bring them into the bright lights of modernity. But I think this is one of the great issues that we as a species really grapple with, and that is the cost of progress, or what we define progress. We tend to look at one thing and forget its entanglement with other developments that raise deep concerns. That said, there is always an aspect of Enlightenment thought that was critical of the Enlightenment itself. And so it's hard, and I think it's a mistake, to paint things with a single brush. Rather, these things are rife with paradoxes and contradictions.
Well, so you write that this period, the period that you're calling the Mortising, this era of death and destruction to humans and non-human nature, you write that weapons and finance drove its violence. And I wanted to start with weapons, which you mentioned briefly. How has the way that people killed each other and killed other animals changed starting in the 18th century?
A couple of things. You know, one was simply that the rise of commodification. So the growth of the world market turned animals and people into saleable commodities. But particularly with animals, you had to kind of kill them first before you could do so. And particularly the flintlock musket was just a real game changer. Earlier weapons, you know, bows and arrows, spears, hatchets, and other weapons were what some scholars have called democratic weapons. In other words, it wasn't particularly difficult for one to build a spear or a bow and arrow. Guns are an entirely different matter. They were ultimately industrially produced. They required lead for bullets and gunpowder. And the instruments of death were themselves an important part of the development of capitalism. So, you know, in thousands of years ago, you didn't have a market, a global market in bows and arrows. In the 18th century, everyone wanted a gun. And so one of the things I do is I trace out the global distribution of weapons. It really revolutionized killing. One could simply kill other people and other non-humans far greater ease than, say, in the 17th century or earlier. You know, one of the stories I tell is of a Portuguese explorer who wanted to enslave a few of the indigenous peoples of Southern Africa, and he was using an old weapon called an arquebus. And, you know, you had to light basically a wick to get the weapon to fire. And so the koi just simply attacked the Portuguese while it was raining and were able to defeat them pretty handily. With the flintlock musket, that was no longer possible. And it allowed this kind of globalization and intensification of violence that was unheard of in the past.
Great Britain plays a central role in the history of what you call the Mortising, this period from roughly the mid-18th century to the beginning of the 20th. I wanted to ask you if Great Britain had any advantages when it came to gun production and how guns, of course, you know, we tend to think of Britain as the place where capitalism emerged as a system and the Industrial Revolution. What role did guns play in the development of the powers of Great Britain and its projecting that power around the world?
Yeah, I think Great Britain had a number of advantages that other parts of Europe and the world did not. The first is they had the British East India Company. And the British East India Company was able to get a lock on saltpeter, which is the crucial ingredient in making gunpowder. Now, other European powers were also making gunpowder, but South Asia produced just massive amounts of saltpeter. And that saltpeter, tons and tons and tons of it, headed to ultimately to England and specifically London. London and England generally also had very significant supplies of lead for bullets. And, you know, and this is a classic story, they had, you know, a great coal and iron ore. But they were also, how should I say, eminently capable of stealing ideas and expertise. And so they, you know, were able to beg, borrow, and steal, particularly from the Dutch. And that helped turn, you know, London into a early center of the manufacturing of guns. The other absolutely crucial, we talked about this a little bit earlier, was the financial revolution. Really, the 18th century sees just remarkable changes in Great Britain that you just don't see other places in the world at the time. And these are the things that, you know, you and I and everyone else are accustomed to every day, you know, checking accounts, savings accounts, stock markets, bonds, banking systems, insurance policies, and a state that was not able to sort of intervene in the ways it once had. And what this really allows in really totally revolutionary ways is the conversion of wealth into investable capital. And since England at the time was heavily involved in the Atlantic slave trade and the rise of plantation economies in places like Barbados, but especially in places like Jamaica, was able to combine finance and guns into what I call the military commercial complex in really quite extraordinary ways. So, you know, you see in the second, particularly in the second half of the 18th century, a rapid growth of the Atlantic slave trade and a really massive movement of weapons into the Atlantic world. And these were generating huge profits that could then be turned into other investments. And so, you know, one of my basic arguments is that we really can't understand the Industrial Revolution without understanding this broader global military commercial complex, this kind of marriage of guns and high finance.
Historian Clifton Craze is my guest. We're discussing his book, The Killing Age: How Violence Made the Modern World. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So you were just describing how guns and this violence were absolutely crucial to understand the Industrial Revolution. And I wanted to ask you how we should understand the relationship of this era of intense violence that you're describing as the Mortising with the system of capitalism itself. You mentioned that the commodification of human labor and also of the dead bodies of animals was a crucial ingredient. And of course, the commodification of human labor is a central aspect of capitalism. If we're trying to sort of tease out the violence, the intensity of this transformative period, which you say has made the world that we live in, how much of it would you attribute to, say, technological innovation like the development of guns, and how much to the system of capitalism itself?
A classic question that has bedeviled scholars for a very long time has been, you know, what is capitalism? When did it begin? And, you know, Adam Smith looked at this. And he uses a phrase called the previous accumulation of capital. And then Karl Marx, you know, sort of lit into Smith and developed a concept called the primitive accumulation of capital. And Marx was really one of the first thinkers to look at the accumulation of capital as a inherently violent process. I think where Marx sort of got it a bit wrong was that there was nothing primitive about it. You know, capitalism has always been and continues to be a violent process. All we have to do is think about the invasion of Venezuela today, or you know, what is unfolding across you know, large areas of Africa, particularly the DRC. But where technology, I think, is quite crucial is that it provides tools to achieve you know, to achieve ends. And here, the weapons industry in Great Britain becomes, you know, very vital. And one of the things I argue is that we tend to think of the Industrial Revolution as unfolding in Manchester with cloth, but you know, it really begins in London with churning out weapons, which then spreads to other parts of England, and then of course globally. And so, you know, I think that we have to begin to recognize more profoundly the connections between violence and capitalism as not simply a stage, but a feature of the system as a whole. And that violence is as I said, ongoing. And until we begin to think of new ways of being in the world, will, I think, continue.
Can you describe the intense violence to humans and animals that was brought to Africa in the 18th century, part of what you refer to as accumulation by annihilation?
Yes, and I'm originally trained as an Africanist. So I thought at first a lot of this material would be familiar, somewhat familiar to me. But as I began tracing things out and connecting the dots, even I was really just astounded. And that's why I call one of the sections of the book African Holocaust. A couple of things were happening all at the same time. The first was the spread of weapons. And there's just a massive export of weapons and gunpowder into the African continent. And you know, weapons are, one can control them as best one can. And so they lead to the rise of what I call a warlordism across the continent. The second thing is, it gets back to this issue around finance, is that this period sees, in many respects, the Africa's first debt crisis. That is, a lot of these weapons are being exchanged through various credit mechanisms, and what you have are large numbers of people in various forms of debt, immediately to other Africans, but ultimately these debt arrangements are leading across oceans and especially to European banks. The third thing is that there were really two things that the West especially wanted from Africa in the 18th and into the 19th century. The first, as we've discussed, are humans. And so the Atlantic slave trade had gone on for centuries, but it really is concentrated in the period after 1750, continuing, in fact, well into the 19th century. The second is ivory. And so I have a whole chapter that looks at the ivory trade and how it supported towns like Ivoryton in what is in Connecticut. And, you know, what one of the things that violence did to both humans and especially elephants is it changes in very subtle but yet very powerful ways people and animals' relationship to the local environment. And so across large parts of particularly West Central Africa, people who were being hunted and enslaved fled to safer areas. They often abandoned relatively fertile zones and tried to get to a more secure area. And they also began adopting different kinds of crops that would provide nutrition or at least sustenance in an age of systemic insecurity. And one of the things this does in large parts of West Central Africa and elsewhere is that it is directly tied to the spread of malaria. You know, we tend to think of malaria as the scourge of Africa, which it is, but also as like not having a history, as if it's been, you know, a timeless part of the continent. But malaria, you know, has its own history, and in the 18th and into the 19th century was tied to the slave trade and the spread of weapons. In East Africa, especially, where you also had massive human displacements, you had really an epical destruction of elephants, elephant populations. And elephants, they're amazing animals in all kinds of ways. But one of the things that elephants help do is they helped control the tsetse fly vector by the ways they consume large amounts of plant matter. And so the, you know, the disappearance of elephants, but also the retreat of elephants, they're remarkably intelligent animals. They knew they were being preyed upon, and so they sought safer areas as best they could. But this begins changing local and regional ecologies in very profound ways, and especially across Eastern Africa and into the Sudan and all the way down into Mozambique, is you see a very rapid spread of the tsetse fly vector, and with it, the spread of sleeping sickness. And so, you know, again, what we see here is the ways in which violence, insecurity, and commodification have these ripple effects and unintended effects that endure for extremely long periods of time. Indeed, in parts of the Sudan, which has also seen, you know, phenomenal amounts of violence, although here now the new weapon are drones, you're seeing a resurgence of sleeping sickness.
And then, you know, following that, thinking about the enduring legacies of this imperial violence, how were many African societies vulnerable to the intense violence, the guns from the West, the intensification of the slave trade, with all the great social and environmental ripple effects that you've been describing? How did warlords, and more broadly, this notion of warlordism, rise in that context?
You know, I think we can look at Africa, but we can also think about this even more broadly. But in Africa, especially prior to the 18th century, societies and cultures were built of complex webs in which they were obligations between ruler and ruled. There was what, you know, some scholars have called a moral economy. And you can see this in many areas of Africa, in which the issue of leadership is not automatically determined by descent, but by sort of complex issues in which questions of responsibility and reciprocity are at play. And so this was like part of the fabric of how societies and cultures worked, and bad rulers were overthrown, people voted with their feet, and the selection of who would be a ruler involved, you know, some kind of popular consent, as it were, or at least put a brake on tyranny. What really happens in the 18th century is a kind of perversion of these social orders with the rise of warlordism. And it's really the rise of what I call immoral economies, and in which that earlier fabric really begins to fray in fundamental ways, and rulers are looking less towards the building ties of redistribution and reciprocity, but are instead looking outwards to these trade relationships, primarily with Westerners, who are plying them with weapons. And so what you see is a weakening of these social fabrics, and more generally, the rise of, in some areas, of states, but of also just sort of these smaller fragmentary polities headed by these men who are, how should we say, thugs in a way, who are pursuing violence as an economic gain, very much, often very much against, you know, their own people. And so you see what, you know, some people have called a kind of an extroversion of political culture and dependence on international commerce. And without, you know, without those weapons, these warlords, their power, you know, disappeared overnight, as it were. But it led ultimately to a far more fragmented continent. And, you know, we see this in large parts of Africa today, where the state is largely absent. And, you know, the poster child is the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The DRC's, you know, rule, well, it really doesn't have rule over large parts of the country. And instead, you have highly militarized groups who, like the warlords of the past, are engaging in various forms of predation to produce resources. Except today, it's not human beings who are the scarce resource. It's things like cobalt and coltan and, you know, strategic minerals that are forcing out of the ground and controlling the flow ultimately into, you know, some of the largest companies on the planet.
Historian Clifton Craes is my guest. The Killing Age, How Violence Made the World, is the subject of our conversation today. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So Clifton, you write in The Killing Age that North America was the most violent place on the planet in the 18th and 19th centuries. Why is that? How is that?
Well, there are really a couple of reasons. One is you have a rapid expansion of colonial settlement and settler expansion. And so, you know, if you just look at the maps of people of European descent moving ultimately south and westward, in many respects, breathtakingly fast. And, you know, there were indigenous peoples there who resisted heroically, sometimes very successfully, settler encroachment. And, you know, one of the things I point out to in the book is that this, the usual narrative that is still bandied about in this country, that, you know, diseases wiped out indigenous populations, just really misses the mark. I find myself coming back again and again to, in the 19th century, how settlers, you know, wrote about this in local newspapers, the importance of exterminating indigenous peoples. That's one thing. Second, particularly across the American South, is you have the rise of slavery, which is a inherently brutal institution and became more violent, more brutal over the course of the 19th century with the intensification of cotton, particularly cotton production in places like Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi. Third is what became the United States was, and in some respects remains, uniquely rich in natural resources. There were just extraordinarily dense populations of trees and animals such as the American bison, deer, and beaver. And once you have the spread of weapons and the growth of markets, and animals can be turned into commodities, you just have this extraordinary spread of violence. And one of the animals I write about at some length is the American bison. Literally, there were, you know, millions and millions of these massive animals, and they were reduced to about, I think, about 350 in the later 19th century. And this killing was concentrated in really just a couple of decades once people learned how to turn body parts of bison into saleable commodities. And so bison hides, you know, end up on the factory floor. Bison bones end up in what was Detroit's largest factory before the automobile revolution. American settlers, or those who at the time had citizenship rights, loved violence. They enshrined gun ownership in their constitution, and they pursued violence in really quite profound ways, and were and did kill and destroy everything they could if it made a buck. When you add the destruction of indigenous populations with the destruction of the natural world, what became the United States emerges as a uniquely and profoundly violent place. And that violence was largely economically driven. And we really can't explain the rise of the United States as an economic superpower without really coming to terms with our country's intensely violent past, and I should say, regrettably present.
You just mentioned whaling, and I wonder if you can describe the violence of whaling, what you describe in the book as a kind of deep water genocide.
You know, like other many mammals, and particularly many large mammals, whales are really quite incredible creatures. And for much of human history, people have used their bodies. Either usually when they died naturally and wound up on shore, or in North America, whaling relatively close to shore. In the 18th century and into the 19th century, whaling becomes a truly global business. And so you have whalers literally sailing around the world in pursuit of these animals. And in fact, they adapt the flintlock musket pretty early on to the pursuit of whales. And whales produced various commodities, most importantly, whale oil for lighting. And there was a massive demand for lighting in the 18th and especially in the 19th century. And we have to remember, you know, that before the age of electricity, factories were lit, and many sugar plantations in the Caribbean were lit using various oils, and particularly whale oil. So the price, the value of whale oil increased, and with that, a absolutely relentless pursuit of these great animals, you know, well into the 19th century, and whaling, of course, you know, continued into the 20th century, and continues in some areas to this day. But the American period of whaling is particularly pronounced in the 18th and 19th centuries. And that oil, lit factories. What whalers knew, and the companies who organized these expeditions knew, is that this was a declining resource, and that they were literally hunting animals towards extinction. And the men who profited from whaling, they knew that the demand for lighting was constant and growing. And so they began reinvesting their profits, the capital, into other ventures and factories, but also the very earliest beginnings of America's fossil fuel economy. And so we have to kind of look at the connective tissue between what I call a pelagic genocide and America's industrial and fossil fuel revolution. And it's really, I think, very important to remember that whales are profoundly social animals. They have their own social and cultural lives. And people knew this. There's now a lot of writing about it by scientists. But at the time of the great age of American whaling, whalers knew this as well. Perhaps most famously, Herman Melville. And that's why I use the word genocide to refer to this extraordinary moment of quite literally killing for capitalism.
Clifton Craze, let me end by asking you about the lineages, I guess, the tendrils or even the worlds made then and ours today. We, of course, are living through a very violent age ourselves. And yet when we look back at that period of roughly a century and a half from the mid-1700s to about 1900, the tremendous levels of violence that were meted out against peoples around the world in places like North America. How should we understand how our era is connected to that one? Much has been written about the idea that we are living now through, and that would encompass this period, the Anthropocene, that humans have now played a disproportionate role more than ever before in human history in shaping the rest of the planet. Why do you feel like the terms of that conversation or discussion are inadequate?
One of my concerns with the Anthropocene is that it tends to fixate on technology. And so when Crutzen first coined the term, he pointed to the steam engine, and then kind of the rest is history, as it were. And I worry that the Anthropocene leaves out the violence of the past, but also the contingency, that is, the struggles, the warnings, that what humans were doing to the planet and to themselves was not going to end well ultimately. And so I felt that the word is kind of paradoxical. It's both an acknowledgement, but at the same time it flattens. One wants to know, well, which humans were doing what to whom and for what reasons. It just never quite sufficed for me. But with regard to one part of what you asked, I worry that the period we are in the last few decades, it feels very much like a replay of parts of the 18th and into the 19th centuries, of an erosion of any kind of moral economy. And let's, you know, just talk about our country today. The fabric of the United States is, I think, at best frayed. The responsibilities of leaders to citizens seems at best weakened and perhaps broken. And globally, we are seeing a re-democratization of the means of destruction. That is, that weapons, more and more in, weapons are becoming accessible to more and more people. And the drone today is in some respects emerging as the what the AK-47 was in the post World War II period, and what the flintlock musket was in the 18th and 19th centuries. And with this new technology of killing, we, I think, regrettably are facing profound challenges to human culture.
Clifton Crace, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Clifton Crace is the author of The Killing Age, How Violence Made the Modern World. He's professor of history at Emory University and the author of multiple books on empire, colonialism, and poverty. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.